Join the conversation in Clare on Facebook, Twitter, or call 1850 400 964.
We'll meet our Friday panel very shortly. Before that, let's remind ourselves of some of the main news stories of the past 7 days.
For example, Frank Clark was appointed to the High Court without going through JAB. Adrian Hardiman and Donal O'Donnell were appointed as barristers directly to the Supreme Court, but they did not have the experience of ever being Attorney General.
Marta Whelan is no Frank Clark, is no Adrian Hardiman, and is no Donal O'Donnell. You strain credibility by putting her in the same league as the individuals that you've named.
I have never seen such unanimity about anything around the commission table as I see about Ireland, in terms of trying to, in understanding the difficulties that Ireland are put in through no fault of their own because of the decision made by their big neighbour.
Today I'm going to be setting out some of the UK's plans, particularly on how we propose to protect the rights of EU citizens and UK citizens as we leave the European Union.
Definitely you will see a further decline unless something is done immediately about it. It can be changed. It has to be done now before it's too late. And now is the time. And definitely you will see a decline unless the changes are made.
It's too hot for us, but we're not used to it. Hotter the better. Love the weather. Because they're complaining when it's raining and when it's dry. Shouldn't be. Should enjoy it. We don't have enough of hot weather.
Some of those enduring and enjoying the sun during this week's mini heat wave. Before that, you heard from Martin McMahon, the head of the ICMSA in Clare, on the declining number of farmers here. Commissioner Phil Hogan and UK Prime Minister Theresa May as the Brexit issue continue to take up the headlines. And at the top, a clash between Taoiseach Leo Varadkar and Fianna Fáil leader Micheál Martin over the appointment of Máire Whelan to the Court of Appeal. I'm joined in studio at the moment by Gabriella Hanrahan. She's a community liaison officer at the University of Limerick, and by Tony Killeen, former Fianna Fáil TD and Minister for Defence. Our third panellist hopefully with us shortly. Good morning to you both.
Good morning, Gavin.
Thanks very much for joining us this morning. Tony, starting off with yourself, how would you assess the palaver with regards to Máire Whelan this week and the fact that Fianna Fáil have made such a big issue about it?
I'm not surprised that Fianna Fáil have made a big issue about it, and a whole lot of side issues, of course, have been drawn into it. I've been trying to read up about it, and one of the things that strikes me, and it's always a difficulty politically if this happens, is that there are questions outstanding. Mm. Now, the government hasn't made a good job of explaining exactly what they were about. Now, that's partly because a lot of them didn't know what was happening, I suppose. But if there were a bit more clarity, it would be got off the agenda quickly. I have a feeling about it that it could be a very long, slow burner. And if that's the case, a very embarrassing one.
You mean that it's not over?
It's certainly not over. One of the things that will keep it alive for the next 2 or 3 weeks is the fact that the replacement courts and courts officer bill is coming into the Dáil and Shannon. Mm. So that'll be up for debate for whatever, a couple of weeks, 3 weeks or whatever.
This is the one that this is Shane Ross's baby, is it?
Yeah, so it'll be constantly coming back in to play. So it's hard to know where the exact background is. It's complicated by the fact that there are very clear procedures in the 1995 Courts and Courts Officer Bill in relation to the role of the AG, and particularly in a case where the AG is being made a judge. Mm. It would seem to me that none of this mess would have happened if the AG had been appointed to the High Court, for example, and one of the three or four, whatever it is, judges who were interested in the Court of Appeal had been promoted. And I don't understand why or how that happened. Obviously, the government felt that Máire Whelan had given good service and deserved to be given some job. She'd given a lot of service to the state for 6 years, and that's fair enough. And unlike Paul Gallagher, her predecessor, and Michael McDougall and others, she doesn't seem to have a lucrative private practice to go back to. So, I mean, I've no difficulty with that part of it. It's just that so many of the procedures that are set out fairly clearly in legislation were circumvented or sidestepped.
But Jim O'Callaghan and others have admitted that there's no laws being broken here. That, I mean, whatever you make of the optics of it, whatever you make of the way in which it's been handled, whatever you make of the fact that the laws in this area look like they'll be changing very soon, that nothing illegal has happened.
Well, that's what everybody says, but it seems a bit strange that laws for procedures in relation to appointments would be set down and wouldn't be adhered to. Like, if that were a job, say, in a county council or a school or even a private company, and a dissatisfied, unsuccessful candidate appealed, they'd have the legislation to rely on and probably be successful. Now, that won't happen in this case because judges don't appeal, you know, in instances like this, the three or four who are interested. But it just seems strange that the Act was there and everybody knew about it, and Maura Whelan knew about the three judges who were interested, and they still proceeded. And then all of that might have blown away if a bit of time had been left between the appointment and the swearing in with the Uachtaráin, and suddenly the Department of Justice comes to life on a Sunday and prepares a warrant for appointment, and it's over with the President on Monday.
By Monday morning.
You know, it just... It makes it more difficult to explain, and it isn't a good start for Leo Varadkar in that regard. Okay.
Gabriella, what are your thoughts on this? Does Joe Public care?
Well, that's exactly my perspective on it. And this is where I think there are absolute parallel worlds between the political world and the ordinary Joe, great Irish public. Because really what we're dealing with here is... the appointment of elites within the Irish system, which would not be open to the majority of Irish citizens. So while politicians are jumping up and down about it, the Irish public absolutely know that nepotism exists in the public sector in Ireland, in politics and in every other public part of Irish life.
But this government made a big deal about insisting that there would be openness and transparency, and yet here they are.
Come here, what government didn't? What government would stand up and say we don't want to be open and transparent and we don't want to do everything? There is no government going that's going to say the otherwise. So we in the public know that that's what the aspiration is, that we'll have an open, transparent system. But the majority of the public know as well that there's nepotism is rife throughout the system. And what I would say is this is where the public gets so annoyed. The amount of hours that has been taken up in the Dáil around this issue, when we have trolleys in A&E, which I've experienced very recently, driving an 87-year-old woman up and down the corridor because there was no space, that every time a trolley came up, we had to move other trolleys and get her up and down, they're the issues that really concern the public. This other issue can be dealt with offside, but not using up really, really important Dáil time where there is really significant issues that impact the majority of Irish society, not just the few.
There's two former TDs sitting beside you. You can give out to them. Michael McNamara, former Labour TD, is with us as well. Now, good morning to you, Michael.
Good morning, Evan.
Maura Whelan was a Labour appointee, wasn't she?
Initially, yeah, but she was retained. I suppose it was a bit of a surprise, really, when she retained her position as Attorney General in this government, because usually she did tender her resignation to the Taoiseach in advance of the Cabinet being selected and was reappointed. Then there was a bit of surprise, but I suppose, I mean, Maura Whelan's an interesting character. I mean, Gabriella talked about elites. I mean, she's not kind of from the typical elite background that the upper echelons of the law library come from and that attorney generals typically come from. You know, she's a woman, which is unusual for a female attorney general. She's from East Galway. She didn't sort of come through that private school system that a certain cohort and the majority of the upper echelons of the law library come through. And I think that there was a lot of resentment of her at the time when she was initially appointed back in 2011 because she wasn't from, you know, there was a certain feeling that you know, there was a sense of entitlement by a certain group within the law library and that they had been passed over and why was this happening and this was awful and, you know, could eventually have some kind of a meritocracy there and that'd be terrible altogether. And I think some of that lingered. And I think, you know, there were echoes of that. I think that is still lingering. But undoubtedly, the method in which she was appointed was wrong. I mean, it's not illegal, but it was wrong.
Or you mean to the court, not as
Attorney General? Well, not as Attorney General, no. But to the court. It wasn't illegal, but it was wrong. Is she fit to sit in the Court of Appeal? Yeah, I think nobody's saying that she's not. I think everyone, Jim O'Callaghan, Michael Martin
made his suggestions.
He said that she was no Frank Clark, but I mean, you know, that's a good thing and a bad thing. I mean, you know, I mean, or that she's no... And I say, Adrian Hardiman. I mean, Adrian Hardiman obviously passed away last year and he was a leading jurist. But, you know, everybody brings their own approach. All judges are different. I mean, Frank Clark is undoubtedly a great legal mind, but he's not unique in the superior courts in that regard.
Well, what do you make then of what Gabriella had to say, that people are fed up with the fact that there is nepotism, or so it seems, rife within the political classes?
Look, I mean, rightly or wrongly, there's a convention which goes back to the foundation of this state that sitting attorney generals can, if they apply or if they're interested, have first sort of refusal on senior judicial appointments.
So that's a
convention. Well, I'd say it's not a soft landing. I mean, many of them have a very lucrative landing when they go back to private practice. She's choosing not to go back to private practice. There is a convention that attorneys general have first sort of refusal on judicial appointments. Inevitably, they're qualified by virtue of the fact
But that convention is looking after those who you've worked with over the past few years, is it not? When heretofore they've been appointed by a government, when they've sat at the cabinet table for so long, what one person's convention is another person's looking after.
Yeah, but, you know, you could equally, I mean, there's a big problem in Ireland with regard to judicial appointments and getting rid of judges. There's a huge problem with as well. I mean, you can't, once they're appointed, you can't get rid of them. I mean, I'm not saying that you should be able to get rid of a judge because you don't like their politics. But, I mean, you know, there are district judges who cost the state a fortune in judicial reviews because they refuse to hear people from certain ethnic backgrounds because they say, well, my policy is this, and they don't hear the case at all. They just... And, I mean, up the country, there are one or two who cost hundreds of thousands of euros every year, and they can't even be sanctioned. There is a problem with the whole judicial system, and a bill is badly needed in that regard. As regards High Court judges, how they're appointed, I mean, the reality is that there's a perception, at least, that Fianna Fáil governments appoint Fianna Fáilers
and Fine Gael
and Labour to a far greater, in fairness now to Fianna Fáil, to a far greater extent than Fianna Fáil did when they were in power, the concentration of... So it's not just, you know, in the making an Attorney General onto the Court of Appeal, there are other judges put onto the High Court or elevated from the High Court to the Court of Appeal. And there's a suspicion, at least in the law library, that it has a certain amount to do with their political affiliations.
Okay, well, a Labour Attorney General as she was, I wanted to go back to yourself, Gabriella, to reflect on what was said by Mary Lou MacDonald of Sinn Féin this week when she suggested there was misogyny at work in some of the coverage and some of the commentary around this one. Would you agree?
Well, similar to nepotism, you know, misogyny is embedded in the culture of Irish society as well. So I'm not really sure. I know the comments that Bertie or geez, gosh, that Micheál Martin made could be interpreted as such. I'm not convinced that was his intention, to be honest. And like when I talked about elites, I'm not talking about the person per se. I'm talking about the position as opposed to the person, you know. And Maura Whelan, I wish her all the best, and it's great to see women in those positions. I'm really, those kind of things aren't an issue for me in terms of it's the best person for the job. I'm just talking about the overall process. And we saw it right throughout when Leo appointed his cabinet last week. It was about all those that were loyal to him. Was it about the best people that could do the jobs? I'm not convinced. And we see it over and over and over again. Mm. I mean, the general public scratched their head a lot of the time and go, how was that person appointed there when they have no experience in that area? So I just think, you know, shut up and get on with it and move on to what matters with people in Irish society.
And I don't think what Gabriella is saying is not unrepresentative of people. I think a lot of people, Tony, would agree that they want to see more substantive issues being dealt with. So how has Micheál Martin played this in your view, or has he overplayed a hand that could see people angry at Fianna Fáil for continually making an issue of this? Twice this week they brought it up in Leaders' Questions.
Yeah, Gabriella's right about two things, or about several things actually, but two of the things are that a lot of people really are scratching their heads and saying, exactly what's this about? And I think one of the reasons for that is that the elitist piece. But I think the other piece is they're having difficulty understanding how it was done so badly when it would have been fairly easy to do it properly. So that's a bit of a thing in the back of people's minds. In Micheál Martin's case, he was in the Dáil chamber facing the other side, which, you know, Michael and myself did many a time. And the Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, threw out two names. Now, I would think of all the judges that might have been pulled out, he could hardly have picked out two worse ones in terms of making a comparison with anybody. Mm. So, and Micheál Martin was responding to that. So that's the context in which you were saying.
Oh, yeah, I appreciate that. But yeah. I guess the fact that I think maybe she was also trying to score political points, but what Deputy Mary Lou MacDonald was saying was that you know, the fact that there's been so much about this is in part because Maura Whelan is a woman.
Yeah, and she included the Garda Commissioner in that, incidentally. Mm. Yeah, which is another one that I think the public are probably saying, look, if the politicians have to deal with this, would they just deal with it? You know, and that is the real difficulty for Micheál Martin and for Fianna Fáil, that there's a very strong perception and with some factual base that Fianna Fáil really could act on, have acted on several occasions if they were really dissatisfied with the government. Now, the view is that the agreement that they have with the government sort of supersedes other things. And obviously, in the back of their minds, they're thinking exactly what Gabriella said, that most people would think we were daft if we pulled down a government on this issue.
Yeah.
And that's a fair point, and, you know, it's a reasonable thing to be taken into account. But what this actually means, I think, is that whatever level of trust there was, and quite frankly, it seemed to me there was a fairly high level of mistrust already, but whatever level there was, is quite badly eroded. And where previously it would have taken quite a large boulder to derail the government, I think a couple of fairly small pebbles could do the trick now, because the interesting thing about it is that an awful lot of people are saying to Fianna Fáil, put up or shut up. And when you're put in that position,
You eventually put up
on a particular day, and you're much more likely to when you're in that position than when you're sort of out in clear territory.
And I thought John McGuinness was very forthright in this programme yesterday.
He was very straightforward about it. And of course, that's where this is at. And then, as Gabriel said, Leo's not in a great position after the appointment of ministers in his own party. And what completely flabbergasts me in relation to it is 57 TDs voted for him. He had 33 jobs to give out. The least number that any previous Taoiseach got that I can remember was 30 votes more than that. In your time, Michael, Enda Kenny had more than twice as many people voting for him for Taoiseach and had to pick from among them. And he was able to pick two-thirds of them and managed to still leave a lot of difficulties and question marks. And
but is that
issues.
Not always going to be the case?
Well, you'd understand it being the case if there were 80 people as there were in your time, Michael. In the not promoted ranks. What when there are only 20-something?
But that would make you even more annoyed.
Possibly
I don't agree with what you're saying there, because if you're going to pick 40 or 50 or 30 out of 50 and I'm in the third that's missed out, then it's a lot easier for me to say I'm better than that one and that one. When there's such, you know what I mean?
I would look at it the other way, because in 80 people you can be certain there are a whole lot of people who are very qualified, and I would always have felt that Michael was one of those people, and I was a little surprised. And I'm thinking about County Clare, like Fine Gael have 2 TDs here, and they don't have them in a lot of places, and they couldn't be too satisfied with the outcome. Congratulations to Pat, by the way. But I think Joe has reason to feel, you know, somewhat aggrieved.
Okay. Michael, just to finish then on this one with yourself, picking up on Tony's points with regards to an election coming out, A, are you going to run? But B, would you agree it's coming soon?
I certainly agree with Tony that it's coming a lot faster now than it was a week ago. You know, and it's because, I mean, I suppose when Micheál Martin is, you know, was the Sunday Independent, or one of the papers anyway, the Independent, I think, had a cartoon of him as the Grand Old Duke of Cork, you know, leading the troops up the hill and down again and up the hill and down again. And I suppose, like, Barry Cowan had sort of said that the Irish water thing was threatening the government and it didn't come to pass. He was fairly jocular at the time of the housing initiative and this rent caps in Dublin. And again, there was nothing really happened. And then Jim O'Callaghan said that the appointment of Maura Whelan threatened the conference and supply. And, you know, you can only, I suppose, threaten so often before something small brings it down. And I think, it certainly, and there clearly is no trust at all, nor could there be when private telephone conversations between the Taoiseach Leo Varadkar and the leader of the opposition Micheál Martin, when they're being relayed across the floor of the Dáil. I mean, so there's
back
channel to discuss anything, so everything is now going to be there on the floor of the Dáil, and that's no place to seek to make amends.
There's an olive branch put out today in the front page. You didn't answer my A question.
I don't know. It's not some, look, it's, put it this way, I'm beginning to I'm just concentrating on farming in the Barra for the moment, and we'll see what will happen if and when it happens. But I honestly, I don't know. I suppose I retain an interest in politics.
A politician's answer.
Second of all, I decided.
Join the conversation in Clare on Facebook, Twitter, or call 1850 400 964.
Welcome back. Our Friday panel still with me in studio, Michael McNamara, Tony Killeen and Gabriella Hanrahan. And they're with us on this, the 23rd of June, which is 1 year to the day since the people of Britain went to the polls and decided, actually, yes, we would like to leave Britain, or we would like to leave the EU after all. And yet here we are a year later and it is still making massive headlines, Gabriella. Unsurprisingly, on one hand, when you consider the seismic nature of the decision, but it's been some year.
Oh my God, it's just... And the hole gets blacker and blacker and bigger as we realise the impact that this is going to have on us in Ireland and Britain and mainland Europe. And we don't even know what the impact is. It's just an enormous problem for everybody.
You sound fearful.
I am absolutely fearful, yeah. Because I think we've... like Ireland and Britain, we have the common travel area since, you know, since time began. Yeah. How that's going to work out in any final deal is, you know, it's going to be challenging. It precedes our common travel area, it precedes EU legislation, but are the EU going to support what preceded their legislation so we can continue to have that common travel area? Mm-hmm. Like, there's a couple of things that really bother me and that I really worry about. It's in terms of, we have no connection to mainland Europe transport-wise. We have through air. We have the underground tunnel that our people use to transport goods over and back between Europe and Ireland. And that England really is the link for us,
yeah,
transport-wise into Europe.
Not anything, but a lot that goes on backs of trucks to France.
Oh, my God, like you think of the way people buy online now, the way goods are transported from Europe to Ireland, and we transport our goods over and back, our meat, fish industries, all them. How is that going to be managed if we don't maintain that common travel area? And yet the common travel area is the one thing that Britain are absolutely resolute in saying that that's the area they need to tie down more than any other area. So for that reason, the other one is in terms of ordinary things that affect people's lives, like we don't have the expertise in many of the health areas that they have in England, so we have an option to go to England to have whatever we need done. Mm. How is that going to work out?
Or go to Derry if you're in Donegal, you know, that sort
absolutely
of thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. In terms of our education, in terms of students going abroad to study, going to England to study, in terms of all the Irish people that live in England and that, you know, are Irish, in terms of the Irish that have people in England, yeah, it's...
Some bits of that this morning in terms of...
It's really, really good. It's so frightening and so challenging. And I think one of the frightening things is we actually don't know. Nobody seems to know. They can pontificate, we can raise fears, we can dampen fears, but we actually don't know. And that's what the issue is.
And we're 1 year on from the vote and still...
And we still don't know. Yeah.
And you could have said, and I mean this with respect, you could have said much of what you just said there, you could have said it 12 months ago.
Oh, absolutely. You know? Absolutely, yeah.
And
yeah,
I think one thing that we perhaps didn't see coming, Michael, maybe we half predicted it, but obviously we wouldn't have realised exactly how it went, was the likes of the snap election, weakening Theresa May's mandate, and all that has a massive knock-on impact that we can't quite evaluate as of yet.
She doesn't have a mandate to negotiate Brexit, really. She doesn't really have that mandate, and I don't see that British government, I mean, as precarious as Leo Varadkar's position is, I'd say he'll be Taoiseach longer than she'll be Prime Minister. And what will replace her, who knows, and whether they'll be able to get anything through the House of Commons. I mean, it's a real mess politically, legally. You know, you talked about appointments to the Court of Appeal. I mean, the British judges, a lot of what they grapple with is EU law. What's going to replace it? If it's going to be something different to what's here, how are we going to trade? It's a mess. I mean, even cattle prices took a huge hit. Okay, they were back and now they dropped them again last week. And, you know, they will, in part, I suppose, to do with the drop in value of sterling. Mm. So it has huge ramifications. I mean, you know, Rosslare to Cherbourg ferry route is... Mm. I'd imagine a tiny proportion of the goods that leave come into Ireland from Europe or leave Ireland for Europe come Cherbourg, Rosslare or Cherbourg, Dublin. The great majority go roll on, roll off across England. You know, the common, everyone talks about this, the common travel area being maintained, but at what price? I mean, because, you know, if Britain is leaving the customs union, and they say they still are, although I doubt it, but if they're going to leave the customs union and you have goods coming from France, say Cherbourg into Rosslare and from there up to Belfast, well, you know, if the checks can't be on the at Newry, then they'll have to be at in Rosslare, and would that be acceptable to the European Union? Possibly not. Yeah. Probably not. So it's a real mess.
And I'll ask the same question to Tony in a second, but do you have confidence that the EU will look after Ireland? I mean, there's been a lot of sounds about pro, and I'll start with yourself, Michael, there's a lot of sounds of pro-Ireland and Phil Hogan that we heard in our Vox a short while ago saying that he's never seen such unanimity from the other members on any issue over Ireland's interests, basically. I mean, are we being put front and centre just as lip service, or are we really going to be looked after?
I don't know. I mean, you'd hope we are. I mean, you know, but, you know, the Europe of small nations kind of has been gradually eroded, and you have the European Council becoming more powerful, and the big players like France, Germany and Britain becoming more powerful in that. I don't know. You certainly hope so. But at the end of the day,
you're not confident.
I'm not confident. I mean, you couldn't be confident looking at what's happening in the House of Commons and what's happening across Europe at the moment.
Tony?
Well, we won't be looked after by accident. It's a big job to make sure that we're looked after. And to say something positive about the government changes, I think having given responsibility for Brexit to Simon Coveney was a really good idea. Tying it into foreign affairs and giving it to an individual who is a committed European and who understands the issues. And, you know, that's a plus. And Pat Breen will have a bit of a role in that as well, as it turns out, in some of his new responsibilities. And there will be a huge job to do. I've said here before that one of the advantages we have is that Michel Barnier is absolutely excellent in terms of doing the job. And he's very well disposed to Ireland. But, of course, there are 27 countries and several of the others will see, including Denmark very recently, that advantages that might accrue to Ireland from, you know, a different customs arrangement would be disadvantages for their pork-producing farmers, for example. Yeah. And several other European countries have said that. So there is a reality there that anything that's interpreted at European level as a benefit to Ireland will be directly interpreted in various European states as a disadvantage to them. Yeah. So that makes the job that Simon Coveney has to do, and obviously the Taoiseach has to do, a very difficult job. You know, quite a difficult job. On the other hand, I think we might be slightly too much focused on the disadvantages. And a lot of what I've been reading in the last few weeks indicates that we haven't been doing well in relation to the potential advantages. For example, Luxembourg, which isn't a very big place, and I know it's in a good location, is pretty much wiping us out in terms of international financial services, which will leave the City of London and could easily be coming to Shannon or Dublin, and almost en masse, or certainly to a bigger degree than I would have anticipated, are going to Luxembourg. Mm. Some are going to Frankfurt, which wouldn't surprise any of us because the ECB is there. But I'm a little surprised at some of the other places that are being very successful.
We have had some. Was it JP Morgan during the week, I think?
Yeah, and that's, from expansions. Our point of view, in a very good place because it's near enough to Clare people to, you know, be able to get there without having to go to Dublin to work, which is another issue in Ireland. But one of the really interesting things about Brexit is that 6 months ago, most people would have said to you, I'm sick of the goddamn thing, I don't want to hear it anymore. Whereas now you can hardly walk down the street without someone stopping you and saying, will we be all right? The kind of theme reflected in what Gabrielle said, you know, a worry.
Yeah,
in,
I think so.
In the minds of people who wouldn't be particularly engaged politically, let's say.
Okay. You know? Yeah, it's certainly an interesting one. We'll be back with more in a minute. Let us know your thoughts at home.
Clare FM's Morning Focus with Gavin Grace.
Welcome back to the programme. Our Friday panel is still with us, and this week we asked how much of a future there is for farming in Clare as new CSO figures revealed a drop of 1,000 farmers in this county alone, a 12% drop or thereabouts in the number of farmers in Clare in the 5 years from 2011 to 2016. It's not far, Michael McNamara, of 4 farmers leaving the trade every week.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose farming has been increasingly about getting bigger or getting out, and that's clear a lot of people have gotten out, and those who stay in are getting bigger, and it's not such the family farm that was being protected, and that the object of, I suppose, the Common Agricultural Policy was to protect for a long time. But, you know, there's good news as well. I mean, this week we see that grass-finished Irish beef is going to be sold in the United States, but I suppose you'd worry about what sort of Canadian beef would be sold, and as a result of these trade agreements, what sort of Canadian beef would be sold in Irish.
And Brazilian beef overnight as well.
Brazilian beef, but... you know, what does it mean? Because, like, there's a lot of farmers in Clare who will have grass-finished cattle. But then there's an awful lot of cattle in increasing numbers of feedlots owned by people who went bust, maybe, and they're renting them to Larry Goodman or to the big producers. And, I mean, those cattle are being finished indoors. And is that premium which that product is attracting that's... really should accrue to small farmers across Clare who are finishing cattle off land, which is not an easy thing to do.
Yeah.
But are the big finishers like Larry Goodman and people who have these huge feedlots, are they the ones that are getting the money from that?
So are you saying it may not be, well, a boost to the industry, it may not be a boost to the farmers in the
ground? Well, I personally don't think the Department of Agriculture particularly cares about small producers. The focus is on industrial scale production, be it in dairy. I mean, they're willing to shut down small scale cheese producers. They're actually dying to shut them down. That's my experience of them. And they did in Clare, and they'll do right across the country by imposing standards that they simply can't meet, standards that are higher anywhere else in Europe, because they see those small scale producers as a threat should something go wrong. And I mean, that's a call that they make, but should there be an outbreak caused by one of those small producers, that it would damage Ireland in Kerry, Dairy Gold, the big producers. And it's the same in beef. The Department of Agriculture isn't sufficiently oriented, I think, towards protecting and encouraging small producers in Ireland.
Okay. You'd be concerned then, Tony, for rural Ireland when you see these numbers. I mean, if that trend was to continue very soon, you'd see an awful lot less people working the land.
Well, our society anyway, quite independently of this, is moving towards urban and city living, as is the case internationally. One of the factors in farming that's very important in terms of the numbers is that mechanisation has meant that one guy can do what it would have taken five or six to do over several weeks.
But not in 5 years, though.
He can do it in one day. And one of the interesting things about the figures, the percentage of farmers, is that the workforce has trebled in that 50-year period, when the percentage of farmers has dropped against a much, much, much larger figure. And, of course, the truth of the matter is that employment in industry and services and so on and so forth is a more attractive option for people, in particularly financially, maybe not in lifestyle terms, and that doesn't seem to come into the equation that much. I was reading stuff from Kofi Annan there at the weekend, and he's saying that by 2050 the world will need to produce about twice the amount of food that it currently produces, which quite clearly to me indicates that GM sourced products and foods will have to be much more so in the food chain.
Despite the concerns.
Currently, we all know that about 1/8 of the world's population is in food poverty constantly. So from, you know, if you look at it from that point of view, of course there's a future for farming, because a whole lot of people are living in cities and they have to be fed.
Okay.
You know, but how many people will be required to do it is probably the point that you're asking me, and I'm saying a much reduced number, because it doesn't give the income, and Michael illustrated that, to sustain the big numbers of people, and mechanisation means they're not even needed.
Your thoughts, Gabrielle?
Well, I'm fascinated by Michael's insight there. You know, I hadn't even thought of those things that you were talking about. Really interesting. I know very little about farming, except that in those figures, is it that farmers are small farmers are farming the land, but they're also employed as well?
You never really know really what a census term. I mean, it's whatever individuals put.
Because
down,
I see it in my area that farmers have dual jobs, and I also think that in terms of looking at what we have in Ireland, we're very unique. We're a small island, you know, in the Atlantic, we can be seen as producing really, really high quality goods, and that's the with in small farms, which is really unique in terms of the rest of the world. And I think if there was a focus on that, on growing and developing that notion of what we could produce in Ireland that is really pure and that you can't get anywhere else in the world, I think that would be something that should be looked at, okay. You know.
Hopefully it works for us. We'll leave it there, and thank you all for your time this morning. That was Gabriella Harnahan, Tony Killeen and Michael McNamara. We'll have another Friday panel next week. Good morning to you all.
Thank you.
Sorry for being late.
If it matters to you, let us know. Contact us now, 1850 400 964 or email focus@clare.fm.